Hello, and welcome again to the Let's Do a Crime podcast. I'm Ryan, he, him.
Patches, they, them.
I've been in public safety, including law enforcement, for over 10 years, but I am not a police officer.
I am an aspiring writer who's currently working on a contemporary romance book at the moment.
And of course, during NaNoWriMo, you absolutely just lapped me with word count.
I was determined to catch up on words for this year when I'm not going to have nearly as much time, so.
Fair enough, whereas I didn't do any planning. Okay, so this time we're going to be talking about the most complex bomb in FBI history. So in June of 1980, a wooden bridge in California is destroyed in an explosion. Authorities would later state that they believe this explosion was a trial run for a much larger bombing a couple months later, which was the most complex bomb the FBI has ever encountered. Trigger warnings for this one. I'll say up front that no one gets hurt with this in this specific event, but there is going to be talk about an abusive parent slash husband situation that'll briefly talk on the background information. But this event doesn't hurt anyone. The movies depict disarming bombs as like an intense moment where you have to like cut the right wire or whatever, but in reality that almost never happens. Most of the time, especially these days, they'll either use a robot to move the bomb to a safe place and set it off on purpose. Or they'll disable the device if disabling is relatively straightforward. But people think these are so dangerous because they're so well designed and you can't mess with them because that's like how all movies are. But that's actually usually the opposite. Usually they're dangerous to try to disarm because they're so poorly made that they're unpredictable. So like if you mess up, they'll just go off, right? I cannot stress enough how dangerous homemade explosives are due to their unpredictability. So, like, if you think you've encountered something like that, don't fuck with it. Leave it with professionals. I wouldn't even mess with one. I just call for the police, honestly. Which, incidentally, explosives at disposal is one of the only police jobs I think I'd do, just because I'm weird like that.
So you could become the expert, is what you're saying.
Yeah, like the problem is to become the EOD guy, you have to join the police and like be a patrol officer and go through all the steps and. You can't just jump straight to being the bomb guy, but I'd be the bomb guy if they let me. On
Think they should let you just be the bomb guy.
I think so too. Fortunately, life isn't fair. So on August 26th, 1980, two men deliver a large metal box. It's about the size of a wash machine to the Harvey Casino and Hotel in Nevada. The box is heavy. It weighs around 2,600 pounds. KCRA documentary. So it's like a local news station documentary. Said that even the delivery men had staff help them move it into the elevator and onto the second floor into the administration area. The device had a cover on it labeled IBM, and the delivery drivers claimed it was a new piece of office equipment. The device was a large metal cube with a smaller metal cube on top of it, and the smaller cube had one side covered in dozens of switches. So I could see why, like, especially in the 80s, someone might think this was a computer or something. An extortion note was also delivered to Casino administration, explaining that this was a bomb and claiming it could not be defused. It went into detail that moving the bomb would set it off and that cutting or drilling into it would set it off. It could not be flooded, it had redundant timers, and even that it was sensitive to changes in atmospheric pressure. The note demanded a $3 million ransom in used $100 bills and stated if the ransom was paid, they would be given instructions on how to disarm the motion sensors, which would allow them to move the bomb out of the hotel and detonated elsewhere. That's like the inciting incident here. I just want to touch on why the ransom amount would want the amount in used $100 bills. So one thing that that can be used to track like a ransom if a ransom is paid is to literally photocopy the bills and like all their serial numbers. And so this person was smart enough to realize that that might happen. And by getting used bills, it would be a lot harder to track where he's actually spending it.
That makes sense.
But that's not all. The note also had Hollywood movie levels of details regarding the payment of the ransom. So the ransom was to be delivered by helicopter with a lone pilot. The pilot was to fly low and cover sp and follow specific directions until he saw a strobe light. So it was like fly over this point, go north this many kilometers or miles, I guess, because it's the States, to turn here and like. It's like all those little details, like it's a video game or something. You're supposed to follow the directions until they saw a strobe light, and then land and hand off the cash. The note even specified the person receiving the cash was not going to be the bomber, and that if they attempted to apprehend or fool him, there would be a second bomb. The full text of the ransom note is actually on the FBI website, if anyone wants to go and read it. Like, the FBI website was a good source for this, because they have a whole write-up on this entire incident just on their website for the public. Obviously, the first thing that happened is the casino and the surrounding buildings were immediately evacuated. Guests in the hotel were moved to a high school auditorium. Bomb squads from the region attended and examined the device. They were able to x-ray it and determine that it did appear to be complicated and did appear to actually have anti-tamper measures. Because, like, people have made claims like this before where they're like, oh, this is so complicated, you'd never be able to figure it out. But then upon examining it, it's like, okay, it's actually relatively simple. In this case, no, the x-ray showed that, like, there was some complexity to this, and it appears to be some legitimacy to the note. They could not get clean enough pictures for it to work out in detail, because x-raying through metal is already pretty hard, and x-ray techniques at the time would have really struggled with it. So, like, I think even a modern x-ray, like, wouldn't be able to get that clear of an image, just because metal is hard to x-ray through. So the FBI decided to try to get instructions from the bomber. So they followed the ransom instructions, with two notable exceptions. The pilot was not alone, because of course he wasn't. He was joined by a hidden armed FBI agent. As well, they weren't going to give him $3 million. So the FBI, you know, for one, they're not going to give someone a huge ransom like that. And two, they don't have that much cash on hand just to hand to someone. And the casino certainly wasn't going to pay the ransom. So instead, they assembled a bag with some real cash and a bunch of paper to equal the weight of $3 million. So basically, they stuffed a duffel bag full of newspaper and threw some cash on top of it, hoping it'd fool the guy. They hoped they'd fool him long enough to get the disarm instructions and maybe to identify him. So this failed, though. They followed the instructions, but they could never find the strobing light they were supposed to land near. So instead, they put out a call on TV asking the bomber to contact him and provide more instructions. And here we're going to change perspectives a bit to John Burgess Sr. So John Burgess was a Hungarian immigrant to the United States. He was a Luftwaffe pilot in World War II and ended up in a Soviet gulag, which, for those of you who don't know, if he's a Luftwaffe pilot, that means he fought for the Nazis. He claimed, though, that he was providing intel to the U.S. So his claim is that, like, yeah, he was in the German military, but that he was a spy for the U.S. military. I personally find it pretty unlikely because the U.S. entered the war pretty late, so I don't think the U.S. had a lot of spies in the German military, but that's what he claimed. In the U.S., he built a landscaping business and briefly became a millionaire. And keep in mind, this is in, like, the 60s and 70s, so, like, you know, a millionaire now is impressive, but a millionaire back then would be, like, someone who's got the tens of millions of dollars now. But he squandered his fortune away on gambling. Much of it was at Harvey's Casino, which is where the bomb was planted. His sons described him as physically abusive, and, well, by the way, this is where the trigger warning comes in. His sons described him as being physically abusive, and in the aforementioned KCRA documentary, one of his sons stated to due to their abuse, they were brainwashed to do what he said. As well, his wife divorced him and later went missing. He was never accused of any involvement in her missing, but even his sons suspect him. Blaming the casino for his losses, Burgess hatched a plan to get his money back with a ransom. He enlisted his sons to help him steal over 1,000 pounds of dynamite from nearby construction sites and set about constructing his bomb. His sons later stated they didn't think that he'd really go through with it, and when he had completed the bomb, they refused to help him deliver it. Now, side note here, like, dynamite is actually not that hard to get your hands on. I'm not going to say how to get it, obviously, but it's entirely possible you can stumble upon old dynamite if you live someplace where mining operations were pretty common, like here in Alberta.
It's pretty easy to get dynamite. You just go into a desert temple and dig down.
Yeah. Also, if you go in someplace in Alberta and just dig down, you'll find old dynamite. Reason I bring it up is because if you ever think you found old dynamite, which, like, is just like a tube kind of thing, sometimes it'll be covered in, like, weird, like, slimy crystals. Do not touch it. So what dynamite is, it's nitroglycerin mixed with a type of soil to make it stable. And Anyone familiar with nitroglycerin knows that it's friction sensitive, so it can go off even with a loud noise. And so, like, new dynamite is, like, safe to handle, but, like, old dynamite can sweat out nitroglycerin and can become friction sensitive. So, like, if you touch it or bang it or even make a loud noise near it, it can go off. So, if you're ever, like, in a rural area, especially, like, around where mines were active, and you think you found old dynamite, quietly and quickly move away from it and call authorities because it's super dangerous. Fun fact, here at Edmonton, we have a bunch of old coal mines underneath the city, but most of them have been thoroughly cleared out.
There's old coal mines at Edmonton.
Yeah, so the conference center? The reason why it's built inside of a hill is because that hill was an old coal mine, and they had to fill it with something, otherwise it would collapse. So rather than just filling it through co with concrete and leaving it there, they built the convention center in it.
Oh, well, all right.
Yeah, so that's some fun local history. Anyway, Burgess then enlisted the help of Terry Hall and his father-in-law, Willis Brown. So Burgess had Hall and Brown deliver the device to the hotel. The men claimed they didn't know the device was a bomb until after it had been delivered. And then there's a fourth person, Ella Joan Williams, who apparently wrote the extortion letter. I'm not sure why they brought a whole different person in to write an extortion letter, but apparently that's what she did. I'm back and forth on believing their story about not knowing what the device was, because it is kind of weird that some guy just hired you to deliver this big cube to an office. And it what and because the fact that like it had measures in it to keep it from being moved, it did have to be like configured once it was put in place. So I imagine he had to tell them a little bit about it. So I'm pretty sure them saying they don't know didn't know what them is didn't know what it was just them covering their ass. After the bomb was delivered, Burgess and his two sons were to go signal a helicopter, and yeah, I got a little bit out of place here. So once the bomb was delivered, Burgess and his sons were supposed to go signal a helicopter and wait. So they're supposed to put the strobe light up and wait till the helicopter landed. But according to one of his sons in that documentary, they brought the strobe light but did not bring the battery. Caused them to have to go hike into town and find another battery, at which point they missed the helicopter. So that's why the helicopter couldn't find the strobing light, is because like these guys messed up and didn't actually have the strobing light up there. According to one
So,
of
this whole plan, it went off essentially without a hitch up until the point where the Suns just forgot a battery.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like they were kind of lucky they fucked up, because of course their plan was to like basically ambush the helicopter guy and steal the money. And there's a armed FBI agent in a helicopter, because of course, so they probably would have just been shot if they tried it. But it is kind of funny, because they told a story about how they forgot the battery, so they went to town, tried to steal a battery, got chased off by a guy with a gun, and then went to a store and just bought a battery.
It costs the money to fuck up the helicopter.
Yeah, the best kind of criminal fuck-ups are the ones where like they'd have to just like spend money normally and just lose it. I don't know if you're familiar with 419 scams. That's like the stereotypical like Nigerian prince scam kind of thing. There's a whole group of people online who dedicate themselves to basically just trolling them and trying to get them to spend as much resources as possible. Like the people will pretend that they are actually being scammed, and but not actually give the scammer any money, and just string the scammer along and see how much money they can make the scammer spend before they give up on them. So like sending packages back and forth, or like long distance phone calls and like stuff like that. Yeah, it's basically just like trolling but against scammers, so like they deserve it.
Rolling, but for good.
Yeah. So going back to Casino, the bomb experts have determined that even if they did get the code, they can't really be sure if it disarms the if it actually disarms any of the motion triggers, and so therefore it's unsafe to move it under any circumstances. So like upon examining the bomb, they've come to the conclusion that like, yeah, even if the bomber does cooperate and gives us a code, we can't prove that like one, he built it right, or two, that he's not lying, or three, that he's not just like didn't just mess up and give them the wrong code. So they're like, okay, even if we get the code, there's still a good chance we'll go off, so we can't move it. We have to disarm it or blow it up right here. So any plan to disarm it has an extremely high risk of detonating the bomb. So any plans that require someone to be in harm's way are thrown out. So like the amount of times that someone actually goes over physically and like cuts a wire and disarms a bomb is pretty rare. You're pretty much only going to see that in situations where, one, there's no other option at all, or two, the disarm is pretty straightforward and they can just walk over and do it. In this case, like, they don't have to put someone in harm's way because the area's been evacuated, and they also are pretty sure that, like, one little mess up would set the bomb off, so they're like, okay, we're not going to have a person go and try to disarm it because odds are it'll get them killed, so we have to come up with only the plans that don't involve having a person next to the bomb, which is reasonable in my opinion. In the end, they went through a whole bunch of plans and came up with only one plan that had any chance of working. Given that they figured out that the large cube on the bottom was the explosives and the cube on the top was a detonator, they planned to use a shaped explosive charge to try to shear the top from the bottom off fast enough that it wouldn't detonate. So a shaped charge is like when you take an explosive and design it in such a way that the blast all goes in one direction. So demolitions use this a lot because you don't just want a big bang. You want a bang in one specific direction to minimize damage to everything you don't want to blow up. And so that's basically what they did, is they made a shaped charge. And the idea was if the explosion from their shaped charge is fast enough, it could cut the detonator off of the bomb without actually setting off the bomb. Outside the casino, there's a complete media circus. There's just tons of video. So there's lots of video coverage. If you go on YouTube and search this incident, there's tons and tons of video coverage of this. And apparently other casinos in the area were running betting pools on whether the bomb would go off or even specifically when it would go off. So like this has become like a public event. People are betting on if they can defuse the bomb or like when it was going to go off. On August 27th, the authorities expanded the evacuation area in preparation for their disarm attempt. So they count down and it doesn't work. So the bomb goes off, doing substantial damage to the casino and minor damage to surrounding buildings. So they tried their shaped charge thing and it ended up setting off the bomb, which they already knew that had a high chance of doing that. And it didn't destroy the building, like, almost amazingly, but, like, it did do a lot of damage to it. No one was hurt thanks to the careful evacuation, but there's videos of this, and there's crowds outside watching, like, the countdown, and crowds can actually be heard cheering when the explosion happened.
A bunch of people just made some money.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, a bunch of those people probably made some bets. A lot of them probably just hated the casino, and maybe some of them just liked the good explosion. I mean, like, it's kind of easy to be lighthearted about the whole thing, knowing that, like, this is planned, you know, no one's in the area, like, even though, like, you know, the bomb went off, no one is hurt. So, yeah, I'd say that, like, you know, that would be a fun thing to watch.
It's like watching a planned demolition of, like, a building. It's just entertaining.
Yeah, except it's unplanned, so you got money on this one.
Exactly.
But like, that's not even all. The investigation is also something I have in an 80s movie. So like this whole thing, I'm shocked they haven't made a movie of this yet, because this whole thing would fit perfectly in like a period drama. The investigators comb through the bombing site looking for evidence, but the casino's owners have their own security there because like there's millions of dollars of cash and casino chips that are also in the wreckage. So the casino staff are in the wreckage collecting the money and making sure none of the investigators are pocketing any. And as well, the building was damaged but not destroyed. So just 2 days later, the casino reopened. They put a wall up separating the damage from like the good casino with windows in it so that people could watch the investigation happen while playing the slot machines. So this casino had like a viewing window into like, you know, the crime scene where all the FBI agents are combing through the debris and stuff like that.
That makes sense, honestly. If the casino is going to do anything, it's going to capitalize off a situation and make more money.
Oh yeah, like the casino owner apparently during the shutdown was like most angry that like the casino shut down, he wasn't making money. And this is also one of those things where you hear those stories. We've all heard their stories of like a casino lights on fire and there's people like still at the slot machines when like the fire reaches them. This incident is also one of the sources of that, like, that urban legend, I guess, like, because the fact that during the evacuation they did have to like go and like physically remove people from some of the slot machines, being like, no, you're leaving, there's a bomb in here. Gamble's gonna gamble. Initially, this investigation is really tough due to the casino being a high-risk target. So it's a casino, and this casino is particular. I should have mentioned earlier, this casino is kind of weird because, like, Nevada is, at the time, one of the only states where gambling is legal. And so, like, that's why Vegas became a thing, right? But this casino wasn't in Vegas. It was actually right on the edge of Nevada, on the border with California. So basically, like, California didn't have gambling and Nevada did. So this casino built right, like, literally, like, if you cross the street from this casino, you're in California now, to capitalize on the fact that, like, California residents aren't going to want to go all the way to Vegas to gamble. They'll just cross the border and gamble here. So this was a pretty big player in the area. So naturally, this casino had a lot of targets on its head. There are over 500 leads, but none of them really pan out. So they went through, you know, tons and tons of leads. Like, organized crime still a thing. Like, you know, it's at this time Vegas was moving away from the mobster era, but like there's still organized crime, and so like they were considered because like this is a competition. The other casinos in the area, of course, gamblers who lost a bunch of money, like business partners, like there's just all these people with really good motivations, but none of them really go anywhere. It's not until a year later that there's actually a break in the case. So, the ex-girlfriend of one of Burge's sons apparently overheard part of the planning process. So, for whatever reason, this guy was planning this bombing with his sons while one of their girlfriends was over, which is just genius-level intellect. She heard part of this, and at some point after the bombing happened, she told her current boyfriend what she had heard and saying that, like, I think this is related. It sounds similar. And then the boyfriend turned around and called the FBI. After an investigation, the sons initially refused to cooperate, but eventually made a plea deal to testify against their dad. And in exchange, they were not given any jail sentence. So I think both the boys are still teenagers at this point. And so, of course, initially they're like keeping their mouths shut to protect their dad. But after a little while, they turned around and ended up not going to jail. One son later stated that the investigators and prosecutors actually helped him break free of his father's influence and started proving his life. So he actually credits this investigation as like pulling him out of potentially a life of crime, because like they helped him like realize that his father is abusive and that like maybe he should turn him in. A funny side note, he also, like, this one of the sons, he also said during the, by the way, I'm leaving the sons' names out because I try to leave out the names of people who I don't think are, like, fully the bad guy here. And he was a minor at the time. The son said that during the investigation, before he started cooperating, the FBI bugged his phone, obviously, and they would talk to anyone he called. So he said that he was 17 at the time. He was trying to go on dates, but obviously this made his dating life impossible because, like, if he called a girl or a girl called him and he went on a date with her or whatever, then, like, within a couple days, the FBI would knock on her door and, like, be talking to her and her parents. So, of course, like, they're like, who the hell is this guy? Like, stop talking to him. Don't, you know. And so he said that this made dating impossible. So as a sort of petty revenge, he sat down with a phone book one day and phoned as many people as possible. So he just, like, went through the phone book alphabetically calling every number he could just to force the FBI to run around and talk to all these random people.
Yeah, no, we think the internet is the reason we don't have phone books anymore. It's actually this specific moment is the reason they decided to get rid of phone books.
Yeah, yeah. This one teenager has a trick that that the FBI hates him. Just make the FBI fuck off with one weird trick. Burgess, the father, was sentenced to life in prison. Apparently, he fully this is weird. His Corcus is wild. He fully admitted that the bomb that he made the bomb as he took pride in it because he was like a really prideful man. But he tried to claim that he was forced to build it by some unnamed mobster. So, in the entire court case, he took full credit for the bomb because, like, the FBI was talking about how, like, intricate it was and how it couldn't be disarmed. But he's like, yeah, I built it, but it's not my fault because I was being forced to by this guy you've never heard of, right?
Yeah, my girlfriend from another city.
Yeah, she goes to our school. You don't know her. Obviously, the jury didn't buy this because no one bought this, and like the FBI had already been investigating like every mobster they could that might be related to this, and this didn't line up at all. And when he was arrested, he was actually already planning a second bomb. So, you know, it kind of also takes out the possibility that he was just like an accomplice, because then why would he be making another one? As I said before, the sons got no jail. The other three accomplices were also convicted. But Hall and Brown, the guys who delivered it, made plea deals for a reduced sentence. And Williams, the one who apparently wrote the ransom note, which again, I don't understand why they brought someone in to do that. She was convicted and apparently appealed it and had it overturned. So I don't think she actually ended up in jail. Now, the bomb itself is still like an exhibit in the FBI museum. So they use it as a training aid for like new bomb disposal technicians. To date, no one has been able to successfully disarm an accurate replica of the bomb. So the thing had like layers of countermeasures. It had like tinfoil on the inside, which is hooked to wires. So like if you were to poke through it with something, it would complete a circuit and set it off. It had like motion sensors in it, where if you tilted it too far in one direction or the other, it would go off. It had a plumb bob from like a toilet, like the thing that tells your toilet tank when it's full. That was in it, so if they tried to flood it with water, then it would go off. Like, it just had, like, tons and tons of these countermeasures. And the switches, is all set up, like, a certain set of switches would disable the bomb. But, like, if you hit the wrong one, it would just go off. There's a couple things he did lie about, though. Like, he said that it would go off with a change of atmospheric pressure. That apparently wasn't true. That's just a red herring he put in his letter. So it actually like kind of surprises me that if you go to like the FBI's crime museum, you can see a replica of this, and I'm surprised they show it to the public, but like I guess it's complicated enough to make, they don't really expect people just to be able to go make a new one again. And of course,
yeah, I was thinking of like, if it's in like a museum, why, and it's something that they still don't know how to disarm, why would they let anyone from the public see it?
Yeah, I also think this is the case of, like, you know, realistically speaking, anyone with, like, an intermediate level of electronics knowledge could probably do it. But, like, this is a lot of effort for a bomb. And also, it was, like, you know, as I said before about, you know, homemade explosives being, like, super dangerous to handle, this, even though it was, like, the complicated movie bomb, was also dangerous to handle because the fact that, like, it'd be very easy to accidentally trip one of these sensors yourself. So I think that that's part of the reason why they're not super worried about like a random member of the public doing this again. And as well, like these days, it's a little bit hard to get your hands on dynamite.
But not old dynamite.
Yeah, not old dynamite, but that will definitely go off before you get it to a casino.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm vaguely reminded of a story which, this is a really minor story, trigger warning for this, people do die in this story. But after 9/11, there was a Russian terrorist group that was going to try to make like the Russian 9/11. And so their plan was to go and plant a bunch of explosives around like a really big public square on New Year's Eve. And then at midnight, they were going to set them all off. And what they had used as detonators is they used cell phones, which like we've all heard of that. And so the plan was to like set up all these explosives and then send them a mass text at midnight to set them all off. But what happened was they, you know, when they got in the van to go deliver these things, they turn all the phones on, and they and then on the way to go plant them, they got a spam text message, which set off their bombs and only killed them.
Huh.
So that's just a little funny aside of a weird bobbing fact.
Spam messages only come, only do good once, and it's in that moment.
Yeah, yeah. So spam messages trying to redeem themselves by taking in some Russian terrorists. And so, in 1996, Burgess died in prison of liver cancer. I didn't see what happened to the others, but I do know one of his sons was seems to be fairly successful running a welding shop, and he's the one who was talking to a lot of documentarians. And so, yeah, that's the story of the most complicated bomb in FBI history. So there, this one I have to give a shout out to Quixer on YouTube, because, well, I was aware of this incident. I was watching, I was binging Quixer's channel recently, and came across, he did a really good video on this too. It's one of those, it's an animated YouTube channel. So if you want to have stories like this, but animated, Quixer, it's Q-W-I-X-R, I think. That reminded me the story existed, and so that got me researching it.
Thanks, Quixer.
Do you have any final comments or self-promotion, self-plugs?
I do not, unfortunately. I've been making all of my quick-witted comments throughout the episode, so.
Okay, well, that's it for this week. If you have any stories or comments for me to talk about on the show, you can email me. It's letsdoacrime@gmail.com. So it's all one word, letsdoacrime@gmail.com. And until next time, don't bomb a casino.